This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and it's been a busy week for technical producer Eddie Garcia. At the top of today's show, we heard his conversation with They Might Be Giants frontman John Linnell, and earlier this week, Eddie also got an insider's look at the love language and a conversation with Stuart McLam.
North Carolina has its fair share of indie rock success stories, and one of the latest musicians to make people stand up and take notice of our state's thriving music scene is Stuart McLam, the creative force behind The Love Language. What started out in a Winston-Salem apartment as a lo-fi love letter has developed into a panoramic indie pop pastiche, bringing elements of music's past, present, and future together. A wall-of-sound approach that harkens back to the days of Phil Spector and his recordings with the Crystals and the Ronettes. But beyond the strings, the horns, the glockenspiel, and the healthy dose of reverb, there's the songs. And singer, songwriter, guitarist Stuart McLam has a way with words and melodies that proves the word pop doesn't have to be a dirty word. The latest release by The Love Language is called Ruby Red. It's their third record and second to be released on Merge Records, the home of classic indie rock bands like Superchunk, Polvo, and the Magnetic Fields, and contemporary trendsetters like Spoon, She and Him, and the Grammy-winning Arcade Fire. To say McLam is in good company would be an understatement. You can see The Love Language live at the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Arts, SECA, in Winston-Salem, as part of their Crossroads concert series on Thursday, October 17th. Along with the show, you'll find food, beverages, outdoor activities, and an opening set from like-minded Winston-Salem band, Estrangers. Check WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend for more info. I talked with Stu last week by phone about Ruby Red, his days in Winston-Salem, and the evolution of the Love Language sound. New record, your third album, your second for Merge Records. Ruby Red is out. Congratulations on that.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, I really, really enjoy the record. It's a little bit of a departure from some of your early stuff stylistically. I mean, but you know it's a love language song. You hear those, you know, reverb-drenched melodies. You know it's you.
Yeah.
But, you know,
A
little reverb junkie you are.
Yeah, working on it. I know it's an issue.
Has it always been that way? Like, have you always just had an affinity for it?
I don't know. The reverb thing started with that first record. First time I was recording stuff, so I guess it was more of a math. I'm like, okay, I don't know how to mic stuff. Put some reverb on it, and you get that big sound. But it's definitely a part of this record, but we were using the real deal this time, so that was nice. Some plates and all that.
Okay. Where did you record the new record?
So we did it, actually, at Ruby Red, and it was mixed at Overdub Lane in Durham. Like, a good portion of it was mixed there. The actual recordings went down at Ruby Red, which is like a artistic sort of cooperative workshop in downtown Raleigh. A good buddy of mine, Tim Lemuel, rented the building. It was just like a sort of abandoned warehouse, you know, how that goes. Just kind of slowly started getting some artists, you know, visual artists and musicians and filmmakers, all kinds of artists in there, and slowly started turning into something really cool. Very similar, I guess, to like the warehouse, but mm-hmm. I'd say we're a good 10 years behind with you guys there. So we just pretty much made like a makeshift studio to record in. You know, I was so happy with how it turned out. A big part of that was DJ Burton, who been my buddy for years, and he toured with the band for a while and recorded and engineered Libraries, our last record before this one as well.
So the atmosphere was a little different on Libraries, too, as you were in a studio where this was a new record. It's kind of like you made a studio happen in a really cool space you were working in. Mm-hmm. Now, on Libraries, did you, or maybe you and BJ, play most of the instruments on the record?
Yeah, like we had some people come in. Like my brother Jordan played drums on maybe a little less than half of the record on Libraries. It was mostly the two of us in there, but it wasn't like all the way like that.
You brought a lot more musicians into this record. And I'm thinking like a song from the new record, like High Life, has so many strings and maybe glockenspiel?
I don't know.
Yeah. And these horns. And I mean, how do all those arrangements get sorted out?
So that song in particular, when I remember I did the demo, that one was done in Black Mountain. I went out there for about 2 months in the summer of 2011 and sorted out a lot of the writing for the record. And we were like in this kind of, it was a cabin, but it wasn't like some remote cabin. It was like sort of in a residential area.
Did you grow a big beard while you were out there?
That demo, I think I just busted out like a standard like Casio that's got like the multi-tone banks, you know, mm-hmm. got like strings, horns and everything. And I think I just kept layering with that until it had sort of a big sound just for the demo. I just kind of went back through and remembered what had worked. Parts on this record are like really crazy for that. I mean, you know, when you're bringing in a string or horn player, they're classically trained and knowledgeable, so these are pretty easy to figure out. And then, you know, the strings are like one of my favorite parts of the whole record, and that was Rachel Rollins, Mark Paulson, really good friends of mine, live in Raleigh. It's sort of adorable. They're like a couple as well. Mm. They both play violin, but they added a lot to the arranging. They definitely helped me arrange certain parts.
I'm thinking about the song On Our Heels.
Mm-hmm.
Has that really simple but such a sweet, you know, little string line. Do they have something to do with that part too?
I think we did like kind of write that on the spot.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely collaborative too. I think they helped me tweak like the end of the phrase or something.
Yeah, it really adds, you know, really a nice little extra something, especially with the song having like that kind of a laid back disco feel, like having those kind of strings.
Yeah,
kind of
that was
bop on top.
Like, one person kind of Cure kind of vibe or something.
Yeah. You know, with this record, you're definitely trying out some different things.
You know, it's funny. I mean, there's parts of me that you listen to, like, the first record, and then you listen to this one, and it's, like, two different bands almost, you know. With Love Language never being, like, a constant live band, or I feel like it's a project that I'm going to kind of, like, as long as it feels sincere and it is with me, I'm going to try to take it along with me and my, like, you know, not trying to sound cheesy, like, my life journey or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, let that follow me to where I'm at as long as it feels like it's relevant, you know, tool for me to express myself. So that was one thing. I just felt like Love Language to start it out as like this sort of, you know, from this place of like lovelorn breakup songs, whatever you want to call it. That was something that would be really difficult to like perpetuate and like identify myself with. So I just chose, like, I thought this record would be a good one to just totally break that mold and to open it up to some new themes and some new styles where, like, basically trying to like set the groundwork where I can kind of like take it wherever I would need to go. Like, you know, like I can try to do an 80s record or try to do something heavier or go back to do like a lo-fi garage record next, like whatever. But just to like, for people to have no expectations about which direction you go, that frees me up to just, you know, not get stuck in a box.
It's kind of funny. I was like, well, the Love Language is not really a band in the traditional sense. You have a band,
yeah.
You are a band, but it's like, it's almost like the rapper for you. It's like your project. I mean,
yeah,
really, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, I've thought a lot about this and talked about it before. Like, you see this a lot more this day and age with bands, with members coming and going and switching, and people can afford to do like their own records by themselves at home and multi-track. And the band, and then in a lot of ways, all over is sort of, I don't know, it's not as tight as it used to be. I mean, there's still obviously bands, but I see that as like a lot of my friends' musical projects, as people kind of come and go, and there's not even money in music anymore, you know. And so it's always usually these short-lived things, and this is something that I wanted to really push to kind of keep going. I mean, naturally, it is my thing, but I very much need people to, like, bounce ideas and feed off them and help bring things to light. But it just seems like, naturally, you know, it's sort of a revolving door. I think from the outside, people can look at it and be like, oh, Stu's, like, this tyrannical, loving is like this crazy dictatorship, and he's firing people left and right because the lineup changed. But that's hardly the case. It's always been like more about like, well, that was a rad tour, I got a job offer, I'm gonna do this, or like, I'm really stoked on this project, or I'm moving to this town, I'm getting married. You know, that's been a lot of why people have come and gone, is just their lives have had things that come into their lives that were more important to them than this band, which I totally understand. It's like, I'm the broke dude in the band, other people are doing cool stuff, you know. I feel like people look at it the other way. It's like, why wouldn't they be in the band? It's like, because you make no money doing that.
Lyrically, this record, it's also stretching out a little bit. I know I talked a lot about the music and the sonics, but lyrically, it seems like there's more of hopeful, embracing, spirited feel. How did that all kind of come?
I mean, it took a long time to get this record out. I struggled a lot with writer's block, and I think that was me just trying to like sort of figure out how to get out of it, like the whole breakup theme or what I was supposed to write about. I don't know. I guess I was like kind of in a funky place, and then I started to write. But a lot of the lyrics actually came after Black Mountain. A lot of the music was done there, and some songs were completed lyrically then. But I came back to Raleigh, and I ultimately just decided it would be good to just explore like some more universal themes, you know. I realized that this was a good opportunity for the record to get outside of myself and my ego, would bring other people in, and not writing these songs with I and me all over the place. So I've always written from like sort of a cryptic kind of place. It's really hard for me to write a song about one particular thing, but I feel like it's always like a jumble. But one, like, it's vague, but the underlying theme of the record, I think, is just this feeling that this like new sort of era is approaching pretty swiftly, you know? I feel like everybody kind of feels it. It's hard to like put your finger on what it is, but technology is making these great leaps every day. We're like trying to catch up with that. And I feel like just the overall consciousness is, we're starting to like see through some of the old ways, and
things really seem like we're just, they've been in flux for a while, but now we're starting to get on the other side of it. Maybe I think people are finding new ways to do things, new ways to form
like
their lives.
It feels like a really big change. I mean, I think, yeah, exactly. It's like this weird moment, but it's about to flip kind of.
Yeah,
that was the theme. It was sort of like this like death and rebirth kind of thing going on in the record.
So I remember when you were kicking around town a couple of years back. Why don't you tell everyone about your Winston-Salem connection?
Yeah, that started with the local superstars, Auto Passion. And we met them, my old band, the Capulets. We got up with them, and this was back in the MySpace days. And I remember a buddy of mine, William Cashin, who's in Future Islands, actually, they were Art Lord and Self Portraits back then, but he mentioned, he's like, you should check out this band, Auto Passion. I think you guys would be a good fit. And we listened to it and just loved it. And we set up a show and went to the Salem. They just like really simply became some of my best friends in the world and still are. Yeah, so then we just kept in touch and played some shows and had some girls in town, and I ended up getting in a pretty serious relationship with a particular girl, and then I moved to Winston, and I stayed there for about 6 months, and it's funny, that's actually where those were the first Blood Language songs were written, was living there, Gray Court Apartments. That's one of the songs on the first record, was Gray Court, because I was living out there. And that was pretty much it. I lived there for a while, and if you listen to the first record, you know that the... It did not end in roses, but it was, we're still good friends and everything, but it was 6 months that I look back on very fondly, but it was a little rough in the middle of it.
So I just got to say, I'm very curious, what has the experience been like being on Merge Records?
When it happened, like when I got the news that we were getting signed, that was just something, even though they're local, I just never imagined that would be a reality for myself. They were just a legendary label. And when that happened, I remember I laid down on my bed. I just think I stared at my ceiling. I don't even know what was going through my head, but I swear I think it was for like 3 hours. I think I was just like sitting there, like staring blankly at the ceiling. It was really like a dream come true. It's like crazy to experience something like that, you know?
Yeah.
That's how it was for me. And, but I mean, as far as like them as a label, it couldn't be more laid back. It's just like, you know, they have such a far reach, and they can do a lot for an artist. Obviously, they've been doing it for a while, and they've been in the business for a while.
But, and they've had some pretty major successes over the past, you know,
yeah,
5 to 10 years,
they
too.
They know what they're doing. But at the same time, you know, it definitely still feels like a small label. Like, they, in a lot of ways, too, you know, like they're right in my backyard. And
yeah,
I feel so fortunate, you know, to not only just to be on that label, but for them to just be right in my backyard. It's a really great thing. It doesn't feel like they're like too big, you know what I mean, of an operation or something. It's still very personable.
They've retained their values.
Yes, yeah, definitely. I think when they sign an artist, they really let them do their own thing. So it's funny. Like, sometimes I'm just, like, all freaking out, like, what do you think? And then they're just like, it's great. All right. You know? They're not, like, they're definitely not one that's, like, sit down. You have to pass the, like, merge test. You know, they just let their artists express themselves and get behind it. I mean, if I, like, tried to rap on a song or something, we might have a conversation or something.
Maybe they make that a download only.
Yeah. And I got skills, you know.
I'm sure. All right, Stu. Well, it's been great talking to you. And
yeah, you too, Eddie.
Yeah, I'm
a pleasure.
Glad you could be on the show. Stuart McLam of The Love Language. You can see the band live at Sika in Winston-Salem as part of their Crossroads concert series on Thursday, October 17th. Winston-Salem band Estrangers will be opening the show. For tickets, music links, and to see the video for the Ruby Red track Come Down, visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Technical producer Eddie Garcia. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and whenever possible, we like to leave them laughing. To wrap up today's show, we're going to go straight to the gags with two of the best in the business. Did you know the art of comedy is alive and well right here in the Triad? It certainly is, and much of the credit goes to the Idiot Box Comedy Club in Greensboro. There you'll find a veritable beehive of activity going on year-round. This fall is no exception with their monthly Knuckleheads production, an all-ages, kids-friendly show with stand-up, improv, and sketches. Comedian Eric Trundy and club owner Steve Lesser are teaching stand-up classes. And Friday night at 8 at the Idiot Box, it's round 2 of the 6th annual Ultimate Comic Challenge. Eric knows the UCC well, as does Idiot Box co-owner Jenny Stenzel. Jenny's a comedian and improv actor, well-known to Triad audiences. From 2006 to 2010, she was the comedic traffic reporter on WXII-TV. Her on-air antics, like rapping the traffic report, eventually wound up on CNN, VH1, and MSNBC.
I want to get your perspective on that. I mean, dealing with comedians all the time. Give me the real dope. I mean, what's that like, Jenny?
Well, I mean, you can't stop laughing. It's a great job. Right. They are big babies, but every single one of them.
I thought it was funny on, it was Joan's show where she's in bed and talking to comedians, and Sarah Silverman was on, and she asked Sarah, do you have any friends that aren't comedians? And she said, no.
Yeah,
she couldn't envision hanging out with people that can't make her laugh. I thought that was kind of interesting. Is that the scene generally, or is that unusual?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you get to the higher level, comedians call regular humans civilians, you know, and so all humans. And so it's just, I heard Bill Burr and Louis C.K. and they were saying how they don't hang out with civilians really. It's they hang with themselves, and you're constantly on and getting funnier. And so these guys who are 20 years in, they're always funny. They're just always on because they have to be, or they get torn to shreds by their closest of friends. You know what I mean? Comedians are big babies, very sensitive, most sensitive people you'll probably ever meet. You know?
Yeah, I remember last time we were going to have a big bear hug afterwards.
Yeah.
To make you feel a little bit better.
Yeah. That's what it is when you're on stage. You're asking for hugs, you know, and I say that a lot on stage. I go up and I say, hey, look, no matter what happens tonight, I'll be the guy outside, and if you see me with my head down, it's just me asking for a hug. That's all I want.
Rodney Dangerfield was right? I mean, comedians don't get much respect. What would you like for folks to know about what goes into it or any aspect of being a comedian?
It's a very strange thing. I think there's only a few jobs in the world. I was in an elevator in Chicago, and a bunch of people had just got off one plane and were transferring to another plane, and two guys started talking. It's like, hey, what do you do? And it made me think, there are very few jobs when you say it in a room full of strangers that piques everyone's interest. And I think comedian is one of those. There's just something about it that people are attracted to.
I looked through the CV here and I see that you're offering classes along with Jenny Sussman and co-owner of The Idiot Box, Steve Lesser.
Yep.
Comedy classes are really, in my opinion, a very silly thing. I've never believed in them. And I always thought they were a waste of money and time. Sure. But the great thing is that we have people that have come through and taken them, and they've been comedians longer than I have. And then people who have just never done it, it's on their bucket list. And so a few of the things that we try to work on is just stage presence and building good habits. And so we bring people in there, and we get them to open up as much as they feel comfortable with. And then we try to point them in the right direction. And I feel like I'm uniquely qualified to teach a class like that because I've just gone through everything that people who are new I got to go through. So I can say, these are the pitfalls you're going to run into. These are the walls. These are the stumbling blocks. And these are the good things.
What's a stage presence thing that you come across frequently that you can tweak and make a difference?
There's minutia that just goes into it. There's, you know, are there barriers between me and the audience? Are my hips facing them? Am I making eye contact? Am I stuttering? Am I looking down or am I looking up? Am I just making eye contact and engaging? Is it conversational?
When you say eye contact, and I live in the minutia, so don't worry about that. But I mean, like, for example, in radio announcing, they say, don't pretend like you're talking to somebody. Pretend like you're talking to a specific person. Like,
yes.
Is it your best friend? Is it your Aunt Rose? Is it so that you have that engagement and you can hear it on the radio.
Yeah.
But in terms of eye contact, are you, I always wonder, are comedians actually looking at individuals or are they just panning the room and pretending to be engaging?
It depends. I think the longer you do it and the more comfortable you get, the more eye contact you're making specifically with audience members. When I first started, I looked at the ground for the first 6 months. And then I was told, you know, you got to stop looking at the ground. So a tip I got from Steve Lesser was just look at the top of their heads. And I did that. And then what started happening is I'm looking at the top of their heads and I started creeping in these little moments of intimacy between me and one person. And that made me more comfortable because I would see them giggle or shift in some way. And now I can engage them completely. I can tell you what everybody in the crowd is wearing after 5 minutes on stage, you know. And
So, Eric, you just had the first, Eric and Jenny, first Knucklehead show. What's a Knucklehead show all about?
Knucklehead show, we're going into the third one. That's going to be in October. It's a once-a-month show. I wanted to do a show for kids, for families, and I wanted to do something very lighthearted. I'm a huge Andy Kaufman fan. And when I saw him play Radio City Music Hall and then he takes everybody in the school buses to go have cookies and milk and stuff like that, that kind of inspired me to do the Knucklehead Show. It's a stand-up comedy. It's improv. It's sketch. And we give out prizes. It's fun for all ages. It's totally clean. I wanted to do something different than I've done. And so about a year ago, I started really focusing on doing cleaner comedy and being able to engage all audiences. And this goes to that.
And your background's in improv, Jenny, is that correct?
Yeah.
It seems like that as a discipline for young kids would be invaluable in that so much of what we do in the day-to-day is just being able to respond to what's around you and kind of improvise in the best sense of the word. But it's hard for some people to do that.
Yeah. We teach improv classes, and we teach kids improv classes. And kids get it way faster than adults.
How do you teach that sort of thing?
Well, you teach the skill set you need to be able to do it. So essentially, improv is about working with other people. And nobody wants to play with the kid up the street that won't play the same games. They only want to play the game they want to play, and they only want to do what they want to do. And that doesn't work in improv. Yeah. And so it's all about taking the other person's idea and adding to it.
Or in basketball, little kids, they all want to shoot the basket, but no one wants to pass. How do you break down, how do you get into that mindset?
Improv is about the assist. So it's not about being the one that, your job is to make the other people on the stage with you, you know, make the shot. So if everybody's working together, everybody's making assists. So at the end of the show, if I made somebody else, you know, gave them an offer that made them get the biggest laugh of the night, it's a good night. It's a good night.
I mentioned
as long as I'm not the worst one.
You get it. That's right.
I'm a good guy, but I'm not that good.
Comedian, improv actor, and teacher Jenny Stensel. She's also the co-owner of the Idiot Box Comedy Club in Greensboro, and she was joined by comedian and teacher Eric Trundy. Friday night, October 11th at 8 o'clock at the Idiot Box, it's round two of the 6th annual Ultimate Comic Challenge. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You'll also find links there to their weekly stand-up performances and classes, Knuckleheads comedy shows for kids and adults, improv classes, and more. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. You'll find podcasts of Triad Arts Weekend, along with pictures and lots of helpful links, on our website, WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.